One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Is going on, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and across the table, monkeying around with the pretty lights on the road, is my friend Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, it's Kyle. My first name is Kyle, not Phil. I don't know why people always get that mixed up because he always calls me Philio Filson or whatever. But if you look at your smartphone. Or your computer or tablet or whatever you're looking at, it clearly says the names of the two hosts, Kyle Filson and Cam Hale. But yeah, I'm glad to be here. The weather is perfect today.
Yes.
After several weekends of it being crappy on the weekend, but good during the week, it's really good. We just had a very good baseball tournament. We did not win. We did end up in the semifinals, but the gameplay was amazing.
Good stuff.
It was one of probably the second greatest game I've ever watched. My son play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a neck and neck battle all the way to the sixth inning, and just one or two little, just small, minute errors cost us in the end. So those are the kind of games that you're not even mad when you lose. You're like, man, that was well fought. My hat's off to the other team. You know, hey man, they did a great job. The only game better than that one was we did really poor one time, and lost both games on Saturday. So if you don't know. These are mostly two-day tournaments. The first day is pool play, so it doesn't matter if you win them or lose them. It just determines where in the bracket you're going to play on Sunday. And Sundays are championship day, which means you go until you lose. Once you lose, you're out. Anyways, so Saturday we did very poorly. When I say poorly, we not only lost both games, but we just got destroyed. So we were dead last in the tournament. This was like, it was a year ago probably. And we came back and won the whole thing. So we went from dead last to win it. And I remember even in the championship game, that other team was beating us early on. And one of the first base coach was standing near me. I was outside of the field. I'm on the fence just watching. And he was telling me about, you see that kid over there? Like, that kid's from Puerto Rico. And his grandpa is like a Puerto Rican baseball legend. He's giving me all this backstory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay. I mean, I don't know how that's relevant to this. But, yeah, and then we ended up beating him. So I'm like, well, it's not like you're born in Puerto Rico. You got some special power.
Obviously, I remember you do.
That used to happen a lot when I used to play ice hockey. You'd run into these guys, and they'd always be like, oh, yeah, I'm from Winnipeg, or oh, yeah, I was born in Minnesota. I'm like, well, it's not like when you're born there, like it's not like it's impossible from somebody from somewhere else to learn how to play the game.
Yeah, not like everybody there plays. Like Brazilians don't all do jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Like there are bull riders from Brazil, too.
It's just silly the way people act like that. But, yeah, it was a great time, and the major leagues are about to start this week. So, you know, this is a really fun time of year for me. I enjoy it. I'm excited. Even the Rangers game openers against the Cubs. It's even better. I mean, you know who I'm pulling for.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. I didn't have such a lovely weekend. I did. My great niece's birthday was over the weekend. She turned 4, so we had a great time celebrating that. But I was pig hunting off and on. And if some of you that follow me on Instagram got to see the hog that I was going after, and he still gave me the slip. But over the weekend, I was setting up a tripod stand and ran a mesquite thorn through my shoe and into the bottom of my foot. And yeah, so now I'm hobbling around on that bet. Now, it didn't break off in there, but it went in there. If I was, without exaggeration, a solid half inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch up inside my foot. And for those that don't know, it's got some sort of something on it. I don't know if you could say it's poison or what it has on it, or if it's there's something, and it is not awesome at all.
I remember years ago I was camping or doing something outdoors, and I had just flip-flops on or my slides.
Yeah, you step
and I stepped on one, and it went all the way through into my foot. Like in the I don't know what part of that foot is, the arch.
The arch.
And
like, just your foot. That's all you need to know.
It like broke off in there, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I tried to dig it out, and I was able to get some of it out, but I couldn't get it all out. And it just kind of healed over, and I forgot about it. Well, fast forward like 3 years later, I started getting this like bump on the top of my foot, and it was like starting to fester a little bit, like it looked infected. Mm-hmm. And I was squeezing and jacking with it, and the tip or the point of a mesquite thorn came out. So it must have broken off and slowly worked its way
around
all
the bone,
the way through my feet.
Wow.
Years later, because I mean, I had no other explanation, but that I was reminded by that. But yeah, it was painful. My foot kind of swole up.
Yeah, this isn't cool. It hurts now. Yeah, it's not a good thing. Like, I mean, all you can do is keep it clean. But, and of course, any puncture like that's always sort of healed, because you don't want it to heal on the outside, then you get this big hole on the inside. But it didn't work like that. It just thunk, thunk, in and out. But yeah, I was squalling for a second out there by myself. I was like, oh, help me.
Oh, believe me, I hurt myself too at one of the most recent baseball practices.
You're so old.
I was playing long toss, you know, and getting further and further apart. For people that don't know, when you start to practice, I'm usually warm up your arm where you start really close, 10, 15 feet. Mm-hmm. And as you keep throwing, you work further and further apart, you know, to warm your arm up. If you just come out blazing, you're going to hurt yourself. Or if you're old, you can hurt yourself. So this is a question that I've been wondering for a while is when is my son, he's 11 now, soon to be 12, at what point is he going to be able to throw further than me, right?
And you found the answer.
I found the answer. It was last week. He can already beat me. But anyways, as he was getting close to beating me, I was throwing hard, y'all. I mean, I was going at it. And I'm like, nah, I'm not about to let these kids show me up. You know, it's a manly thing. I'm not letting this happen. So I was giving it, and I didn't let them know, but I was giving it everything I had, and I could tell it was already hurting. When I woke up the next morning, I rolled over, and I thought my shoulder was on the other side of the bed. It hurt so bad. I was like, dude, I might have to go see a doctor.
Yeah, that's pride.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And so, like, 2 days later, Caleb Jacob's like, what's wrong, dude? You look like you're wincing when you put your shirt on. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm wincing all right. I almost need a sling. It's better now, but, boy, it hurt bad.
You learned your lesson, didn't you?
Yeah, don't try to outdo a young person.
No, it's not. You could have done it 20 years ago.
Yeah, I did the mistake one time. This is not the first. See, I'm a dumb person. This is not the first time.
No arguments here.
I remember about, 15 years ago. I had a buddy on my team that worked out quite a bit. He was a young guy. He was like 20, 21. And at that time, I was about 30, maybe 35. I was about 33, I think. Anyways, he worked out all the time, was in good shape. And I was like, you know, I need to start exercising more. Maybe it'll make me a little faster, probably help out, you know, just whatever. And he's like, all right, man, come meet me up here. And it was Bally's gym back then.
Mistake number one.
So, right. So I did a leg workout. And he's like, oh, you just do the same one I do. I'm like, okay. Well, about halfway through the workout, I'm like, dude, this is really hard, but I'm not going to let this guy know that I'm a punk. I'm a wuss, right? Yeah. So I'm just going to crank him all out. I did. I finished the workout. When I left there, I looked like a baby deer.
What about
deer.
The next day?
I looked like a newborn giraffe trying to walk on its legs first. The next day, I swear to God, I could hardly stand up on it.
I've done that.
It was terrible. And he called me up like 2 days later. He's like, you ready to work legs again? I'm like, hey, Evan. I'm like, I'm lucky if I can walk by next Thursday. I am not working. I was like,
I'm sick, bro.
I think I ended up going to that gym like maybe 4 more times. And then that was it. That whole year subscription. I think I left.
I'm out.
I'm like, dude, you almost killed me. It really was painful. Like I was soaking in Epsom salt baths. I mean, I was trying to just lightly massage it. It almost made you want to cry.
You know what I remember? I remember when y'all lived over there off of Charles or Winona.
Uh-huh.
And all y'all lived together, and we all showed up one night, all of us from high school. There's like 15 of us. We were all in there drinking, and then we got out the weight bench, and everybody started trying to max their bench. You remember that? And it was all lifting. I think I blew my shoulder out that
night. Right, because you want to be like, dude, that's all you can lift. Do you even lift,
right,
bro?
Right.
Yeah.
You're trying to bench. You're like, I used to bench X amount back in high school. Then you're back up underneath it now, trying to put up like 2.5, and you feel like your shoulder's going to go.
Right. So the moral of the story is, if you're around a bunch of young guys and you haven't worked out in a while or you hadn't thrown a ball in a while, don't try to outdo them.
Nah.
It could end bad, right?
It's pride. Don't let pride mess with you.
It happens to all of us.
Every one of us. Yeah, I'm glad y'all are here. We have some cool stuff to get into. Some cool stories. I've got some cool stories that I learned over the weekend from someone that sat and told me some things. And then we got some neat news stories.
Yeah, before we get, I was going to say, before you get into that, let's start the news. Check this out. This comes from a woman named Karen in Seattle.
Hey, Karen.
And
how's the weather up there?
She talks about an alien encounter near the Grand Forks Air Force Base.
Hey now.
She said, I'm finally going to come out and tell my red ship story. I was very small at the time. I was maybe 3 or 4 years old, and I was at home sick. I used to get a cold very often and the flu almost every year. And it just was a big annoyance. So this particular time, I was at home sick, and I was upstairs in my bedroom taking a nap. That's when I woke up. I woke straight up and looked out my window, and then I got out of my bed, went downstairs. We were in a duplex in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Well, as I went downstairs, I then headed into my kitchen. Then I walked to the back kitchen door, and there's a door to the basement and a door to the garage on my right. I looked out the kitchen window, which is straight ahead of me, and above the one tree that we had on the block, which happened to be in our backyard. Above that tree, there was a red UFO. It was smallish, maybe 30 feet long. It was like in the shape of a parallelogram. It was rectangular, but it was slanted in front and in the back. The sides were just a dusty brick red, and it looked like it was segmented, and it had two grasping claws on the front. And there were two guys sitting in the front of the thing. The front was enclosed, but I could see through it. Now, I am just standing there, staring out the window, looking at this ship. And my mom comes over and she says, sweetheart, what's the matter? Do you feel okay? And I didn't even pay attention to her. I looked at my dad, who was making salad for dinner. I looked at my dad and I said, Daddy, don't let them find me. They're looking for me. Daddy, please, don't let them find me. And my dad, he was at Malmstrom Air Force Base during the big UFO flap from a few years earlier, dropped the silverware. He looked over at me. He walks to the door in front of me and closes the little drapes that we had. He looks at my mom and says, get her back upstairs and put her back to bed. And I looked at my dad one more time. I said, please, Daddy, don't let them find me. I walked upstairs with my mom. So I got back in my bedroom. I crawled over the bed. Now, remember, I'm only 3 or 4 years old when this happened. I looked back out the window, and now it has moved from over the tree to over one of the streetlights a little further down on the road. And it's kind of sitting at an angle, but down a little bit. And the guy in the front, remember, there's two guys in the front of this ship, I swear to God, turns and looks right in my bedroom window. He looks right at me, and he looks pissed off. I said, Mommy, Mommy, there it is. There it is. There's the ship. But don't let them find me, Mommy. And my mom's upset because she said, Honey, I don't see anything. And I sat down on the bed and I just couldn't even say anything. Both of them, they were wearing like red coveralls, like kind of a one-piece thing. They had a silver belt with little square things on them. I could see their whole body. They had on black gloves. Their skin was very silver, but they looked humanish. Their features were a little more exaggerated than human, and they were wearing very dark black glasses. Goggle-type things, visored. Something was definitely over their eyes. Their skin was silver, like I said. Their hair was silver also. And the guy who was the closest to me was extremely angry, and it was like he was sitting in one chair and then up a little bit, like maybe a couple of feet higher. There was like another level, and there was another guy sitting over in that chair. All of a sudden, they spun on the butt end of that ship, and they took off, and about a minute later, we heard a noise, which we later knew were the alert aircraft takeoff. Now, for those of you who've never been on an Air Force base, the alert aircraft takeoff is when a bunch of fighter planes are alerted, and about 10 or 15 seconds later, you'll hear them taking off. These things came because we lived at that time at the back end of the runway of the base, and we saw these jets screaming over the house. I'm 57 now. I've thought about this every single day since it happened. This is the first thing I think of when I wake up. This happened near Grand Forks Air Force Base. So that's a pretty crazy sighting, pretty crazy encounter. She saw this tiny craft. It had claws on the front of it. She could see the two things piloting.
Her parents didn't see it.
The mother claimed she didn't. The mother was like, I don't see what you're talking about. But the father seemed very alert. Alarmed.
Yeah, that's
like
weird.
Like he knew something, or I don't know. But it's a disturbing case. You know, when it comes to alien abduction, I mean, it oftentimes starts when these people are very young. Like they usually seem to start with children, mm-hmm. and they're abducted several times over their life. Sometimes they're giving false memories, whether, you know, their memories erased and don't really remember it. Sometimes you have to go to have be put under hypnosis to even recall the
no
details. I wonder how, I mean, I know that people claim that hypnosis is effective, but then I've read other articles where people are like,
you can be led.
It's kind of effective. But like if you saw a really scary movie like Fire in the Sky and then
I'm
all
not
of a sudden,
doing it. I don't want to know.
Right. Oh yeah. If it happened to me, no, I would not want to know.
I don't want to know.
Right. It'd make it even harder on you.
Yeah. I don't want to know.
I figured if the aliens
assume,
are
like,
wiping
that's
your,
all fine and well.
Wiping your memory, they're doing you a favor.
That's exactly. That's what I'm thinking. 100%.
Anyway, it's pretty cool.
I've got you one here that there's a lot of these going on that's it's. I'm just going to cover this one.
Sure.
Maybe I ought to get into talking about these because it's weird because this is something we haven't really discussed. But I have discussed a little of it in the past, but this one's going to be really interesting. And I thought it was cool because Lon had shared this. But this is about a giant ground sloth.
Yeah. Oh, the ones that used to that live in North America?
Yeah, this one.
Somebody found a skeleton?
No. This was spotted 9 years ago in San Jose, California.
A living one.
A living
nine
one.
9 years ago.
Yeah. Now, my question is this. Like, what would you, in California, what could you possibly mistake for a giant ground sloth? Now, when I read you this story, then I want you to answer this question. It says, about 9 years ago, I came face to face with a giant animal in San Jose, California. I've only shared my story with close friends. I was cat sitting at my boyfriend's aunt's house.
Cat sitting?
Cat sitting.
I didn't know you had to do that.
Yeah, you got to hang out with the cats. You first of all got to let the cat know that you're not a burglar.
Yeah, Hazel cat.
Yeah, a cat burglar. Okay, so I was sitting at my boyfriend's aunt's house, and he was in the bathroom. I walked into the living room, which has a sliding glass door that leads to the backyard. It was dark out, and I don't recall the time. I looked over and saw an animal about 6 to 7 feet tall. It had two eyes. And on its hind legs, it was standing with an arched back. It had long claws on its paws. Its hind legs were very short. And it was only a few inches away from the glass just looking at me. So it's reared up like at the glass.
Yeah.
She goes on to say, I screamed. It turned around slowly, got down on all fours, and left. I ran to my boyfriend and I told him. And to be honest, at the time, I thought I had seen some giant monster raccoon. My aunt had a ton of raccoons in her backyard, and we had just seen one by the door because she would feed the stray cats. It says that she had a big kitty litter bucket full of kibble right outside the door, and the raccoons would actually pull the lid off the bucket and eat away. The animal I saw was standing right by that kibble in the same place we would see the raccoons. Now, she doesn't do that anymore, and I never told her what I saw, most likely because she would think I was crazy. She has a fenced backyard, but it was in rough shape, and the portion by the front, says yard, was knocked down. So I had told a few close friends, and they'd believed me. She goes on to say that I think I even did a Google search back then just to find something, but I found nothing, so I just let it go as a big raccoon. I don't know why the past few months it's been bothering me, wondering what it was and what happened that night. I've never heard the term cryptid, never believed in Bigfoot or anything like that. So I started searching online to explain this, and the closest thing I could find online that was close to what I saw was a description of a giant ground sloth. Was this what I saw? It actually made a lot of sense to me. I've not heard of anyone else seeing anything like this around here, and I would greatly appreciate If you've heard of any stories like mine, and thanks, you know, if they all could let me know, thank you, MK. Well, MK, there is a lot more sightings of giant ground sloths that have taken place within the last, you know, 20 years or so.
Really?
Yeah. More than you would think. Yeah. More than you would think, which again, still brings back this. Is it really a thing? Like, it can't really be there. These things have been gone 12,000 years, 13,000 mm-hmm. years. These giant ground sloths have been gone. If they're here, first of all, they don't move quickly. You would see a giant ground sloth. You would see something along those lines, especially in San Jose, California.
Yeah.
So again, it made me think about the timelines. We know as time is linear as we see it, but if time's not linear, is it one of those things where they're bleeding back and forth? Are we living in the same time that was 12,000 years ago and the veil's thin like we've talked about, and that's why you see giant ground sloths or ropin or pterodactyl or any, what is going on? How do you explain giant ground sloths? There's nothing you're going to mistake for a giant ground sloth.
No, we need to start the GGSRU, the Giant Ground Sloth Research Unit.
Okay.
Start putting out trail cams and trying to find these things.
That's right. Well, we've already got Glimmer Man stuff going on, which we've received a bunch more of those. That's kind of started its whole thing. Now we're going to start talking about giant ground sloths, this whole deal. So yeah, it's going to get interesting. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be discussing some missing hunters and missing people. When we get back from that, I got a couple of stories I want to share with y'all that I learned over the weekend. So let's jump into it. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right, guys. As I alluded to before jumping into this little segment, I'm going to be talking about some missing people. I'm definitely going to be talking about some missing hunters, being that we've been doing a lot more of that, and that, you know, Kyle and I have a trip planned coming up here in the end of summer, and we don't want to be one of those people. Now, that would be a problem. It's not like y'all would believe it anyway. Y'all think we was framing it up for the show. We're missing. Now we're back. But yeah, I'm going to get into some missing hunters. I've done some in the past. Everyone really seemed to enjoy them. I've got some notes here. I've got my computer open. And then I'm going to wrap this up with not a missing hunter, but with something we'll cross it whenever we get there. The first person that I'm going to talk about, though, went missing back in November of 1963, actually on the 17th, and it took place in Idaho. The fella's name is Martin Woodward. Now, I like to cover these stories, like, as you all know, whenever we have not just people involved, but whenever they bring out like a lot, you know, it's one thing whenever they just get a few people, like we've discussed, you could easily walk past certain things, but it's like whenever you can take to the air, cover a lot of land, you would think you would have a good chance of finding this person or persons that go missing. But Also, what leads me to this is that Martin, at the time of his disappearance, was 22 years of age. So it's not like he was one of these older gentlemen that you know, venture off into the woods. When I say older, I'm talking, you know, in their 70s or 80s that we've covered before, that may physically not be where they were when they were 22, and things can happen along those lines also. And it's also not like one of the 3 to 5 year old children or, you know, 6 year old children that go missing either. We're talking about someone, not, I wouldn't say in the prime of their life, but a young man who was physically fit, you know, and this is one of those things I always take into consideration of how much distance they could cover and things that they could do in the woods, and especially growing up in this area too. It's not like a flatlander like us, and they're going to run around, you know, like myself, running around in the mountains. I don't really have what it takes as compared to someone that grew up there. So Martin went missing in a place called Keeler Creek in Clarkia in Idaho. Now, this Clarkia is in the Keeler Creek area. It's, I believe it's like 15 miles south, rather, of Clarkia is where it's at. So it's 45 miles east of the Washington border, and it's covered in like thick timber. So you got to imagine like big, heavy, dark timber in this area. And I'm sure, of course, 1963 looked way different than what it, you know, what it looks like now. Now it's, you know, there's houses, you know, now there's things more around it, but also too, it's was logged heavily. There was a lot of logging going on, but in 63, it was just that. It was a very thick wilderness area. And so Martin actually worked at a place called Bunker Hill Company and of Kellogg, Idaho. And he decided he was going to go elk hunting with his stepdad in this Keeler Creek area. So of course they both, now here's what's great. What a lot of people, there's lots of times, I mean, sometimes depending on in the earlier parts of the rut with elk, you go with a partner lots of times. So one of you calls while the other's hunting. As you get later on in season, lots of times you'll split up because the elk are out of rut. So you don't call them up. So you're spotting and stalking and just glassing yourself. So a lot of guys will go in groups and then split off into solo and have areas that they're going to meet up, because calling, you know, after rut, it doesn't do a thing. It doesn't mean anything to them. Well, that's when they went, like I say, was in November. Well, rut's over. So what are you going to do? You're going to split up. Well, that's exactly what Martin and his stepfather, Stuart, decided to do. They get there, they agreed on where they're going to go. This is where we're going to be. And they were just going to be gone for the day. We're just going to run out for the day, you know, split up here, come back here. That'll be that. Well, Martin never shows up. Like most missing people, of course, he's missing, never shows up. So Stuart, you know, waits around. He goes asking around, yelling, never finds him. So what's he do? He heads to the forestry office area in Clarkia, and then goes to the local sheriff's department, and he's trying to get help. He's like, hey, look, this is what's going on. I don't know where my stepson's at. And, you know, this isn't like him. You know, this, he's not this kind of kid. Something has happened. So it doesn't take long till there's over 100 SAR people show up. So the search and rescue are on the scene, ready to rumble. As they start rolling in, of course, now, mind you, by the time he waits at the end of the day, because they hunted till, you know, close to dark, or, you know, where you couldn't see it shooting light. So by the time he gets in, it's late. By the time he gets everyone rounded up, it's late. So it's really late. So officially, the SAR, the search and rescue, doesn't start until November 18th, which, like we've covered lots of times in the past, oddly enough, there's a monster snowstorm starts coming in. Worse and worse for 4 straight days. It's not until November 21st when Larson Air Force Base gets involved, brings out military helicopter, and they take to the sky, bring the helicopter crew. And the crew flies this whole area most of the day, and they're looking for what else? Colors that stand out in the snow and tracks. And of course, you know, you're looking for movement and things like that, but you're basically looking for contrasting colors like someone would wear, and tracks, you know, where you can see it in the snow. And from, of course, you know, we're not talking about super high altitudes like we've discussed. You're talking about staying low and looking for, you know, any sort of animal trailings and things where you can follow them off. So that is exactly what they're doing. They look the whole time flying this area for one day, folks. They don't find anything. They call it off on the 22nd. So they fly one day and they say, hey, look, this is it. We're not finding anything of him. So he went missing on the 17th. It started on the 18th. And by the 22nd, they officially terminate the search. So that lends me to believe I hate to even be this guy. Did they know something going into this that maybe the parents and the people in that area didn't know? They were like, hey, look, if we don't find him this quick, there's no finding him. I don't know. But of course, like any, you know, family would, what do? They enlist the help of friends and other family members, and they're still deciding they're going to sign. So they have to wait, and they have to wait until May. And on May 25th in 1964, now this may be because of the weather and the way it broke and finally could get out there, a whole bunch of friends and family show up and they do their own search, and they spend several days out here searching and going everywhere where they thought he could have gone and search and search. They don't find anything, folks. They don't find any clothing. They don't find any remains of a camp. Nothing. Like where he was, gone. So that's it, right? There's nothing left. It's over. So for 2 years goes by, all the way back into September 65, nothing goes on. It's not until after those 2 years that they find, and when I say they find, some people find a scattered skeleton along a high ridge in the Clearwater County. So it's rather strange. Now, it was never fully disclosed in anywhere that you go and look, in any book that you go and read, that who found these remains. Okay, so they never come forward to say hikers, hunters, other rescuers, park rangers, nothing. Nobody, it's not written down who found these remains, just that his skeleton was found upon a ridge. Now, mind you, too, whenever they left, all right, it's Keeler Creek. So whenever they left, they're hunting elk in the lowland because as, of course, the snow comes in, things like that, it gets harder for the elk to feed up in the high country. So it drives them down lower. Okay. So and that's lots of times the reason they go up whenever it's really hot and dry. There could be more vegetation up in the highlands. So they move with, of course, the availability of food. So when the snow comes in and makes it hard, where are you going to go? You're going to stay down in the lower parts of your hunting area. Well, why would he be on the very top of a ridge if he's hunting elk? I mean, you have to assume this isn't his first rodeo. I think it's safe to assume anybody going up there, it's not their first rodeo. So if he's on top of a ridge, he wouldn't have been up there hunting. And also, too, if he was on top of the ridge whenever he perished, why didn't the helicopter crew see him? I mean, surely he wasn't dead right after he left. You know, so, I mean, it's not like his body was, he was on top of a ridge after he died and then his body was snowed over and that was the reason they never found him. None of this. So it doesn't make any sense at all. Also, too, if he'd have been up there, he would have been sitting pretty much in the wide open where they found him. But I just find it really, really strange that they've never reported on who found it, who found his remains. They've also never given out. When I say they, we're talking about the sheriff's department, the local law in that area, also never gave out the exact location of where he was found, where his remains were found, just that they were found in this area, which is another very curious thing is, are they telling you to stay away from this certain area because they're not sharing this information? Again, it's one of those weird stories. And of course, now, mind you, this took place back in 63. So it's not like it took place in 2018. It took place in 63. So some of these take place a while back, and then some of these are going to be at a little earlier time, but nothing like too close to time. I jump from Idaho to Utah because we have some good friends that live in Utah, and it's another place. If you can't tell, I'm touching on places that I would like to go hunting. I want to hunt in Idaho. I want to go hunting in Utah. They're both beautiful areas. And it's also places, I mean, Idaho, bear. I mean, you're talking about places that there are some trouble for people that could be in the woods. I mean, there is a chance of getting into some action from some predation if you're not careful. So we jump forward now to another young fella named Donald Pack. Now, Donald Pack went missing all the way back in October of 1955. He was just 19 years of age. Now, really, what's pretty crazy is this is in that mountain range area around the Salt Lake City, or the mountains rather east. On October 26th, Mr. Pack had been hanging out, of course, with his parents. Okay, so he's at his parents' house. He decides he's going to go do a little deer hunting. So he leaves about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, like a lot of time too, this is still, you know, when the hours are a little late in the day, so you're not worried about it getting dark early. You know, you don't have to be out there. You know, you want to get out earlier. So what I'm getting at is, it's not like he was running late or he was running. You want to get out there pretty early so you can get in the areas that you're going to be looking for what animals you're going to be hunting, whether it's whitetail or mule deer. You want to be in the woods so you're not disturbing. You don't want to be in the time, like at prime time, walking around. You want to already be sitting and waiting if that's what you're going to do. So he ended up near Dog Lake. So he got to the trailhead, and, you know, at the time, you can go back, they said the weather was really getting sketchy, which is, again, another one of those strange cases. It always seems when somebody ends up going missing, we have some strange weather roll in. Well, that's exactly what happened. So he had his rifle with him, and he actually ran into some other people. There was some other folks who reported that they were like, yeah, we passed him and talked to him and all that. And we watched him move off into the woods, you know, happy go lucky. Everything was great. No problems. Well, 10 o'clock at night rolls around. And of course, Mr. Pack and Don had not came back home. So what's happening? His parents are like, look, even if he would have gotten an animal, it's not like he was miles in. It's not like he had to pack out, you know, something's up. If he'd have gotten a deer, he'd been back by now. Or he would have came back and asked for help to try to get it out of there. So something's up on this whole thing. So his dad grabs the phone and calls down to the sheriff's department and gets a halt down there to a deputy sheriff, Robert Jack, okay? And at the time, Robert was a very young man. Mr. Jack was, Deputy Jack. So he shows up to the parents' house, and he sits in there with them. And, of course, you know, they're, I wouldn't say frantic, but they're pretty tore up. They're like, you know, something's, we just know something's not right. So he takes the full report, and then he leaves that evening and goes, you know, good on him. Instead of waiting, he drives directly. Deputy Jack drives directly to the trailhead. He's not waiting for anything. He's got the report. It's already, you know, there's no telling by the time it's 10 o'clock. By the time he does all this, it's probably pushing midnight by this time. So what's he do? Head straight to the trailhead, and that's where he finds Donald's truck. Now, when he gets there, he realizes, look, I'm the guy in charge. I took the report. This is what's happening. So he starts calling all the SAR people back, you know, whatever you would call them back in 55. And he even says to, I mean, he's like, hey, look, that night when he got in there, it snowed all night while we were there. It snowed all into, you know, into the next morning, you know, late into the next morning. So back then, what do? The searchers come out in all that snow and they bring horses. So they all get horseback and in they go. They, you know, they're checking it all out. And Deputy Jack, of course, goes on to say that the whole time that they were doing all this, every day that it kept snowing, like it didn't let up. So the whole time they're doing, the snow is getting deeper and deeper, and you can't find any tracks. You can't find any evidence, to the point to where all they're doing is exhausting their animals and making it dangerous for stepping off into holes over stumps that are covered in snow. Like you're not going to, we can't find anything. Like we can't even hardly find our way around. Like it's, this weather is terrible. And again, folks, 5 days, 5 days of searching was all it was. And they call it off. It's done. Now, of course, you can imagine it's not like a year or two goes by. It's years, folks. Years go by. And the parents, again, are, of course, you know, they've been, you know, re-interviewed over and over. And like any mom, you know, she's like, I just want closure. I don't know whatever happened to my son. There's nothing, you know, he's just gone. And nobody can give us any answers. You know, I mean, and you have to imagine, too, putting myself in that position, if my son or daughter had gone missing and they had called off the search in 5 days, knowing what I know about the outdoors and all that stuff, I'm pretty sure I would probably quit my job and I would spend every day with my pack on and I would cover every inch of every part of that mountains and valleys until I found at least the remains of that my child. So fast forward from 1955 all the way up into October 23rd of 1982. Yeah, that long. You're right. That long. There are two dudes out hunting, and they were on a ridge that separated Cottonwood Canyon and Mill Creek Canyon. And they were at an elevation on this ridge of a little over 10,000 feet. So we're talking about going way up where it gets way colder. So they're way up there, and they found a rifle that had a round still in the chamber, and the safety was still on that rifle. And of course, they're like, what is this doing up here? So they go to looking around, and they find skeletal remains and a wallet. So they instantly call the sheriff's department. Now, here's something I think everybody would love, because the detective that took the phone call was named Robert Jack. Yeah, the exact same one his rookie year in 1955 that answered this was still there when he answered the call in 1982. So he goes, well, I'm going to come up there at least maybe, you know, and you've got to imagine he's probably not thinking about anything other than, well, I wonder what this is. And he gets up there and he opens the wallet and he goes through it. And in the wallet is Donald's Social Security card and a few other identifying paperwork. So at this point, he'd been found. Now, Robert, Mr. Jack, said that he had looked for Ron for 2 years after the initial search. He himself, the detective, went up for 2 years after that and spent all of his free time in the mountains. Of course, I'm sure he hunted and loved the outdoors and hiked. And he spent 2 years of his own time without telling anybody what he was doing, looking for the remains, because it's like catching your first case. I've talked to a lot of officers and know a lot personally, and actually have some officers in my family. And it's always like the very first case they catch that they can't solve haunts them, you know? And it's funny that there's a lot of officers who, like, the very first case they get is almost like an unsolvable case or a missing person. And it's like it makes them go crazy, you know? And I understand. We would all be the same way. You would want to do something with it. Now, Captain Jack believes, which is funny, Captain Jack Sparrow, but his name is Captain Robert Jack. He believes that the snowfall added on to the fact that he believes it was hypothermia, that the snow got coming down so hard that Donald got lost and that he didn't know what else to do, and that it's one of those deals that he had just died from exposure. And because of the snow coming down as hard as it did, that it covered up any and every kind of sign for him. Now, there are a few things, you know, that we'll get into that was kind of odd. But here's this, is that said he was finally happy that he could bring the news back to his parents almost 27 years later. And let him know, you know, hey, look, this is what it is, and I have some remains, and now you can finally bury your son. The thing that he finds very unusual, and a lot of people have found unusual, was that the rifle had a round in it still. And so there was no, he didn't pass away, like we said, from a fire, from a firearm incident. It's not like he had passed away, you know, the gun went off and it killed him or anything like that. And it's also weird that he wasn't firing shots. You know, like they always tell you, you have your gun, shoot a few rounds to try to be found. It's one of those things. So it's either he passed away very quickly or he couldn't use the gun. Now, here's something else that people bring up that they say is what's really strange. They said, how is it that in his wallet, now, and I don't know what kind of wallet it was, but I know several people have pointed it out, is the paperwork still inside of his wallet didn't degrade. After all the snow and all the ice and all the warm weather for 27 years, it wasn't degraded. And there's been a lot of folks that are like, man, that's just odd. That's just a very, very odd thing that it's still there. I don't know. I figure if it's in a wallet and it's wrapped up, whether it's leather or whether, you know, whatever kind of wallet it was. And I don't know if they made any other kind of wallet back then or not, but a good leather wallet up under the trees or, you know, whatever it was, maybe in his jeans and all this stuff. If something didn't chew on it, you would think hold it pretty good. So I'm not saying it, you know, and of course we could always go out and speculate, well, what if he was abducted and then brought back, you know, years later, and that's just where they dropped him on the top of a mountain or whatnot. Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing that could happen. I mean, We've covered crazier stuff, but I don't know. It's just, I'm personally glad that they had found his remains. But the thing that I find the most odd is that he was at the top of 10,000 feet whenever he started at a regular trailhead and he was deer hunting. Now I know he was probably trying to get a higher elevation to maybe to get a look at something. And, you know, they speculate, oh, he died of hypothermia. Well, the remains you find it 27 years later, they're not how are you going to be able to tell it was hypothermia? You know, and if they're scattered, if you didn't find a lot of remains, maybe he broke his leg. Maybe he was up on top glassing. He got up top looking for deer. He slipped and broke his leg. He couldn't get out. The snowpack came and he froze to death overnight from shock and all this. And maybe that's just the way it was. Maybe there wasn't anything crazy about it. But the really interesting thing is that the weather came in and did that. And then it took so long. But like we said, at least he was found. Now, another one that went missing hunting. This one's kind of strange too, but it may have a decent explanation. Okay, this is what we're going to talk about. What we're getting into on this one is the Finzi Swamp. It's a wildlife management area. This place sounds like it would be absolutely awesome and a beautiful, beautiful place. The Finzi Swamp Wildlife Management Area is in Georgia. It's 1,500 acres of state-owned property. And it's got 1,200 acres of wetlands, 300 acres of uplands. There is places you can go fish. There is, of course, places for kayaking, canoeing, camping, hiking. It's year-round. You can get in there and get after it. The other part of it is there's like, you know, you can hunt whitetail in there. Bow only whitetail hunting. Waterfowling, which means you can go duck hunting. You know, you can go take your shotgun in there and do a little duck hunting. I think there's turkey hunting and stuff in there too. Now this goes all the way back, way, way back, folks, way, way back to 2003, December 20th of 2003. We're going to be talking about a fella named Chuck Logan Jr. And at the time he went missing, he was 41 years of age. At the time, of course, now Mr. Logan was a single fella, so he was likes to hunt and fish and spend his money on him, you know, and all this stuff. My hat's off to him. Hats off to him. So he goes in, he takes his shotgun and he's going duck hunting. Okay, folks. So we're talking about December. So it's cold, even, you know, it's chilly. He's got his shotgun. He's got his canteen. They said he's got his canteen with him and he brought his best friend with him. His best friend was a black Labrador named Bishop. Which great, great, you know, hunting dog. So him and old Bishop head off into the Finzi Swamp area. And of course you have to imagine, you know, it's right at daylight. Sun's coming up. By this time, he's already got the decoys out. He took a bunch of decoys, got his pin bag full of decoys, got his decoys loaded out there. Now, when you get out there in these swamplands, you're looking for, you know, wood ducks. And of course, there's going to be mallards and whatnot, but wood ducks, you know, good looking duck. If you haven't looked up what a wood duck looks like, they look awesome. So they're going after. So you have to imagine if it's in flooded timber, there's going to be some good duck hunting. And he's got his decoys out. Everybody's out there duck hunting. If it's a public area that you can go and you get drawn for, there's probably a lot of folks out there duck hunting. So they say, of course, by mid morning, you know, everybody's gone by that time, you know, hunting's over with. The ducks aren't flying like they were. They've already landed, whatnot, done their thing, and they're gone. No big deal. Well, Chuck never showed back up. Now they start noticing that this, you know, his truck's parked there. Like, well, what's going on? Maybe he's out there, you know, maybe the truck broke down this side. Maybe he just got lost. So the people that work in the area of the Meshley water, wastewater plant, which is right there by it, notice that his truck's sitting there and the dog's just sitting beside it. So they call it in and they're like, well, this is kind of strange, you know? So a few days go by and then the searchers were like, all right, well, we better, you know, let's really break down on it. So the searchers get involved and they start hunting for days looking for him. And they search and they search. And this duck hunter has vanished in, like I reported to you, 1,200 acres. 1,200 acres, he's gone in Georgia. We're not talking about up in the mountains. We're talking about the wetlands. 1,200 acres. Vanished. They have no idea what's going on. Several of the searchers came forward and said, you know what? We believe that Mr. Logan probably drowned. That's probably what happened to him, that he got out there. Maybe he had a heart attack. Maybe he fell and hit his head, maybe something. And that's what happened to him. So a year goes by and these clues start coming in. And as these clues come in, they start hearing some things that maybe that's not what happened to Mr. Logan. It maybe there was a bit more of a foul play angle going on this. So the family members get together and they start offering up a reward for information leading to any information that might lead to the conviction of someone who might have caused Chuck physical injury, upwards of $10,000. Now they interviewed Chuck's sister. Her name's Kelly Pace. And she actually said that this is what one of her quotes, that we initially thought that there might have been an accident because we were ignorant to the possibility of anything else. But when we started putting the pieces together, it looks like there was more to it. Now it goes on. The investigators are like, well, it's an unsolved mystery. We do not know, you know, this disappearance. So he's just gone. We have no idea. Well, there was a lieutenant in the sheriff's department there in Richmond County. His name's Jack Francisco. And he even goes on to say, look, all I can say about it at the time is it's still an open investigation. We have no really clues that he's willing, of course, to give up at the time. So he's like, it's an open investigation. We're looking into it. And that's all I can really talk to you about it. So like, overall, it's 1,500 acres, 12,000 acres of wetlands. Like we said, 300 acres of uplands. There was over 9,000 man hours involved in searching that area. And the WRD, the Wildlife Resource Division there, got a bunch of park rangers and all that stuff to come out. They got volunteers. They used aircraft. They used guys in kayaks down through the whole area, canoes. They brought out boats, flat bottom boats. They searched everywhere. They went so far as to take cadaver dogs and not only walk them through, but also put them in the boats and boat them through. So if the cadavers are out there, they're going to find it. His sister was even quoted saying, if he was in there, someone would have found him. Now, like I said, you know, he was 41 at the time he vanished. They went to his home to go through his house. Nothing was touched. His sister is going to say this, that there was a fresh pitcher of tea in the refrigerator. There was a fresh loaf of bread on the counter when they got there. And he had fed and watered Bishop. But, you know, he had had food and water. It's not like anything. So Bishop's good. Everything's good. And I said, you know, he was planning on coming back. It's not like he did all that and wasn't planning on. He was planning on coming back. He had ran out there for an early morning duck hunt. And that was going to be that. He was going to come back in. So they go in. They start digging around in his cell phone. They start looking in his phone bill. You can call me on my cell phone. I said he was using, get a load of this, he was even on his cell phone as late as 2 p.m. the day he vanished, which is a strange thing because usually duck hunting's done way before 2 p.m. So they don't understand this. So he called a former coworker of his, an old work buddy of his, and his at his buddy's, you know, parents' paint and body shop. And said that he had asked for a ride and that, now mind you this, that he would contact her again when he was out of the swamp. So maybe it was his lady friend. You know, I'm going to hit her up, something like that. Well, she never received another phone call. There was also two other calls just after two from a woman said who answered a newspaper ad her brother had placed about a room for rent. And that during one of these calls to this person. Now, this is what's really wild. They found the person calling about the room for rent. And his sister Kelly was telling the story and said, the real odd thing is, when that person called about the room for rent, they said a child answered the phone. Said indicating that maybe someone else had his phone, but a child answered the phone. So the sheriff's office at that point gets involved after they couldn't find him. And there's, you know, whispers going on, or there's some sketchy stuff going on out there in that, you know, in the woods, and something's not right. You know, and you know how small town chatter goes, you know, oh, they were cooking meth out there, or, oh, this guy's doing this out there, or, oh, that guy's doing that. I mean, y'all know how all this goes. If you're from a small town, you realize how stories can explode. Just one, here's another one. Next thing you know, the rumor gets rolling. Well, one of the people that called in to tell the sheriff's department called in and said that while they were there, that they had witnessed that there was a van with out-of-state tags in that area. And other ones say that, you know, maybe that this van had been doing something a little sketchy. Now, here's another thing that's pretty wild. It said there was a call that came from the Savannah River Ecology Lab. There was a scientist and said that he was there at the time and that he was counting birds, you know, as part of this study. He said he was, now get a load of this. He said, I was unaware that there was a missing person going on at the same time this any of this was going on. I was just out there doing my research. And he said, I saw a fellow in the edge of the swamp and said that he was wearing jeans and a brown shirt. And he said, when the plane, now get a load of this, he's flying over in a plane. I don't know what the deal is with the plane and counting birds, but this is what this fellow said. He was flying over in a plane. And he said, we were flying very, very low. And he said, what was really odd was that you could tell he didn't want to be seen, that he was trying to hide and duck off into the woods. He did not want the plane to see him. So they start hearing more and more of these phone calls, the police do, and they start getting more and more of these rumors. And then they get a rumor that he's living on a boat in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And then they also get one, a phone call, saying, no, he's here in Maggie Valley, North Carolina. And that's where he's hiding out on a boat out here. Both turned out to be dead ends. There's nothing to them. And they had to look into this. So, I mean, they're following up on every bit of this. There's nothing against the law that says a grown man or a grown woman or grown anybody can't walk away from their life at any time they want to. You can just walk out. It's fine. It's cool. But the police have to follow up on it when you're not contacting your family. They have to at least check up on these things. Now, here's another thing that was kind of strange. The sister said that her brother's truck had some really strange, like, smears on the side window, and that the police even took DNA swabs of the whole smears and all this stuff and was trying to look at fingerprints to see if there's anything going on the outside of the truck. And Kelly goes on to say, you know, she said this, she goes, she said that they should have taken it, that she wanted to get them to take these DNA tests rather, and that they wouldn't take the DNA test, and that she'd wanted them to all be done. She goes, I don't think you can't answer too many questions. You can't close too many doors. She's like, so this could have been something to rule out some things. And of course, you know, the police are like, hey, look, you know, we don't know anything else than we know. They even talked to Francisco again. He's like, look, we've run all the phone calls down. We've talked to all the people. We've looked at everything that we can do. We don't know anything else to do. They even go so far as to interview the district attorney, Danny Craig. And even all the people in that area looked over all the information, this whole thing. And they're like, you know, and he's quoted in saying, we're considering what the evidence gathered to this point tells us. And he says, it could be telling us any number of several different possibilities. I'm like, no joke, dude. Thanks. You know, thanks for really clearing that up. He goes on to say, I can say it's still classified as a missing persons case, but we don't limit any possibilities, that the investigation is an effort that involves several law enforcement agencies at this time, and also our office. So they talked to the chief investigator at his office named Glenn Rowland. And he said, it's impossible to rule out homicide. He said, homicide is something that's always out there and we have to look at, and that we thought for a long time that he was in that swamp, and the DNR people searched, even the family searched with their friends, and couldn't find him. So the district attorney's office goes on to say, you know, hey, we're looking for any leads. We're trying out any and everything. It goes on to say, I know it's frustrating for the family and that they want answers and that they need to know what happened to them. Well, a few years later, they get their answers. A few years later, they get the fact that his remains are found, almost 3 years later, I believe. And he was found, the remains, in chest deep water. And they don't suspect any foul play. What it looks like was that he was out there hunting ducks in his chest waders and may have stepped off in a deeper hole out there, like a low spot, and slipped under the water, and your waders can fill full of water. And that's why they'll always tell you, when you're wearing any sort of waders and you're, you know, hunting like that, you always carry a knife on you, one that you can get to easily. Of course, not down in your pocket, but whether a neck knife, whether it be something that you can get to easily to cut those waders off if you have to. Because if you do not, and they're chest waders, and you fall under and those waders fill full of water, well, then it's a full body size weight that you cannot shake. And if you can't kick to get them off and get the shoulder straps off, well, and especially in cold water already, you're going to drown. And they believe that what happened was that he slipped in there. What ended up actually happening was five men were out there duck hunting in this area. Story goes that they had smelled something. That's right. They had smelled this funky smell back where they were at in this area of like old stagnant water. And that when they went back to do a little investigation, this is what they found. The really odd thing too is that I'm assuming because of the waders and maybe because of the swamplands and all this, that he was decently preserved. You know, it's not bones. It's still, even though it's underwater, it's, you know, this whole deal. But what's really odd about this is he wasn't but 500 yards, I believe, from the outlet of the wastewater plant. And for those that don't know, of course, it's processing water and releasing it into the swamp. It's completely safe. So they're letting it go right there. So even then, they say, and the authorities were talking about this, is like what the really strange thing is that it has all been searched there multiple times by searchers, multiple times by families. More than enough times to find him, more than enough time for those cadaver dogs to find him under the water. Because apparently, of course, when there's decomp and the body bubbles up air and you smell the smell, dogs are taught to key on that. Well, they never found him. So it goes back. And of course, I don't know how you would go about checking it even after all that. You know, so much time passes. I don't know how you would go with the autopsy, but they know for a fact that it was his remains. They confirmed it. And at least, of course, like we said, his family has some sort of closure. The really strange thing is yet again, he's found very, very close to where he originally was. He's found where it had already been searched. Now, we didn't have any crazy weather, but all these searching areas had already been scoured and been looked over and been gone over like crazy. And yet, there he was, right under their nose. And I'm going to wrap this up with a case that's not involving a hunter or hunters in any way, but instead a young woman who went missing 36 years ago this coming Sunday. That's right. This can be the anniversary of her disappearance. Her name is Pamela Lynn Neal. She was born on July 18th of 1960. She went to school at Cherry Creek High School in 1978. And after high school, she went on to attend college at Gunnison in Colorado there before she headed off to Alaska for a year. She lived up there in Alaska because she was photographing, you know, doing just wildlife photography and woodland photography and all that. And after that, she comes back and she goes to Maine with her parents. And then she returns to Colorado where she gets a job in Englewood, Colorado as a bank teller at the Key Savings and Loan. And on March 31st of 1983, she takes off on her lunch break. She has a lunch break at 1:30. So, of course, it's a beautiful day. She starts strolling out. She walks a couple of blocks down to another bank to cash a check, which is kind of weird, but I guess that's where the check came from. It was easier instead of her cashing it at her bank. She goes down to that bank and she cashes it. She takes a couple $100. She puts it in her coat pocket. She stops by the Safeway. Folks, she's at the grocery store. She buys her a lottery ticket. Who don't? She buys her a lunch there at the deli, and she gets her a pack of Winston's. This is back when, you know, everybody smoked. All the cool girls smoked back then. You got your lottery ticket, you got your ham and cheese, and you got you a pack of Winston's. And so she goes to her third floor apartment, and she walks across the street from, which is, get a load of this, right across the street from the savings and loan that she works at, which is, I mean, how perfect is that? Which is even better because you don't have to own a car if you walk across the street to work, which, surprise, she didn't even own a car. She just goes and gets that, goes and gets her food, goes back to her apartment, can eat her lunch, and then walk right over to work. Sounds pretty awesome. Well, she takes lunch, of course, but she doesn't come back. So it's time for her to be back. She's not there. Well, the girl that works with her right in our office in the little desk area exactly beside her is named Darlene Heinz. And Darlene is not only her coworker, but Darlene is a roommate of Pamela's. So Darlene's like, I wonder if she fell asleep. Boom, picks up the phone, calls it. 2:30, calls over there. Nobody answers. Pamela doesn't answer. Well, Darlene's like, what's going on? So she's like, hold on, y'all. I'm going to be right back. Let me just run across the street. Literally 2 minutes, I'm going to walk across the road, walk upstairs. I'm going to go see what's going on. Darlene hangs up. Tells her supervisor real quick, I'm going to be right back. Pam's not answering the phone. This isn't like her. We're going to go find something out. Darlene heads across over there. And she even says that she saw Pamela doing lunch, walking towards the apartment. So she knows she went there. She'd already seen her. There was another witness came forward, said, yeah, we saw Pamela go to her apartment. So Darlene gets there to the apartment, goes upstairs, doors open. And I don't mean unlocked, folks. I mean open, not all the way, but, you know, halfway open, which is really weird. So Darlene calls the boss over there and says, hey, look, I don't know what's going on. The door's open. I'm in the house. Pam's not here. Call the cops. So the police head straight there. So the police get there. And of course, hey, look, door's open. We don't know what's going on. So they all go in. And she had a sandwich, I'm supposing here. They also said there was a piece of fried chicken. There was a little macaroni and cheese and a little dish. All this stuff. It's still in the bag. It's all unopened, rolled up, and it's sitting on the coffee table. Pam's shoes were kicked off under the coffee table, and her keys were on the floor. Now, Darlene said that she usually tossed them in the chair beside her there. They also said that the lottery ticket that Pam had bought there at the Safeway was still in the wallet in her purse, which was sitting down there on the floor next to the coffee table. She hadn't even scratched it off. And that the pack of Winstons she bought was unopened, and there was another half pack still left sitting there. That there were no signs of a struggle whatsoever, but everything in the room pointed to the fact that somebody took her. Now, the neighbors were all, you know, talked to, and they said, hey, look, we didn't see anything. We didn't even hear anything, like nothing. So the cops, of course, do their thing. They shake down the whole apartment. There's no evidence. There's nothing. They can't lead anything to where she's gone. It is literally like thin air, like she evaporated standing there. So they get involved and they get everybody involved. They have a search and rescue dudes coming and walking streets and handing out flyers, and they are going crazy looking for her. They're like, where did she go? Like, just gone, gone. They look, they turn it into a homicide. They don't list it as missing persons. They're like, something happened to her. They start looking. Now, there is a lot of theories that were thrown out. Having problems with her ex-boyfriend or her boyfriend at the time that was becoming her ex. There's all these stories. Now, mind you this. Dark-haired, dark-eyed little gal. Cute. You can go on there and look online. She was 5'4" and weighed 105 pounds. What's she going to fight off? If her boyfriend decided this is it, then this is it. So she's missing, listed as a homicide, and folks, she's never been found. This is all the information I have for you. Pamela's gone and is still gone. They've never had any closure of anybody come forward. None of the theories, they've never found an ounce of anything to point. Anywhere you go, Pamela legitimately vanished off the face of the earth. Someone got away with murdering a very beautiful young woman in broad daylight. Nobody saw her abducted. You know, multiple people saw her go to the apartment. Nobody saw her come out. And she took nothing with her. There was no shoes. So obviously she wasn't wearing shoes. No sign of a struggle. Nobody knows what happened. So again, the oddities of human beings going missing on this planet, as whether you're a hunter or whether you work in a bank right across the street from your apartment, the oddities of how fast someone can vanish is something that I don't think people spend enough time looking into and thinking about. So when we get back from the break, we're going to wrap this puppy up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And we are back. Yes. I hope y'all enjoyed those. Look, old school hunter stories, some new hunter stories, and then, of course, like we said at the very end, we wrapped it up with the lovely Miss Pamela Lynn Neal, who is still missing all the way back from 1983, which, like I said before, you're fixing to be on her 36th anniversary of her going missing, March 31st, folks. So I feel bad for her family. I feel bad for all the families where there is no
closure.
No closure, man. It's one of those things. And this one just seems to be, her story especially, seems to have some real darkness to it. So I just wish there was closure to it. It's just, I can't imagine that. And it kills me for missing people. So folks, I'm going to get into these stories real quick. Now, it was shared to me with a friend of mine and friend of Kyle's and someone that we're very close to. And this person and I was spending some time in the woods over the weekend. And when you put two fellas in a blind that love crazy, creepy stories, and this person really loves them,
AKA the Lunar Module,
blind, you're going to hear some really interesting stuff. And so he starts telling me, he's like, hey, I got a couple stories I want to run past you. And he said, if I can find the links, I'm going to send them to you. Well, I haven't received the links yet, folks. So I'm going to tell you as best I can what was passed on. You can do with this what you seem. But one of the stories, both of them took place in East Texas. One of the stories took place, I wanted to say this happened just a few years ago. I keep wanting to say it's 2016, but I can't really remember the date or the year, rather, that I was told that this had gone down. But anyway, the story goes like this, that this fella had some land, and not the fella I was hunting with. The fella I was hunting with is telling me the story. But so the fella in East Texas has some land that he's grown up on. It's his, you know, it's been in his family. It's a few hundred acres, 200 or 300 acres. They got a big wheat field, lots of trees on it, you know, and this, that, and the other. And it was, of course, his family's land, and now he lives on it. So he's grown up on this land his whole life. He bought the house and everything off of his mom and dad. And so he lives in their house and they live in town. And so he's got his family out there. Story goes, they were doing some pig hunting over that wheat field and it was right at dark. And so the dad and the son are walking out in this wheat field with a rifle and they see the hogs and they're waiting on these hogs to kind of come out there a little bit more to get a shot. So one of them comes out there and the dad shoots one of the pigs, puts it down right in the spot. And of course the pigs scatter. And he goes and he shoots another hog, drops it. The rest of them are still running. He's trying to get on the others, and his son starts yelling, "Dad, don't shoot. There's people in the tree line behind the pigs." And the dad's like, you know, he drops a gun. He's like, "Do what?" So they start looking, and they notice a guy in the tree line. But the dad tells him right then, he's like, "Son, if that's a guy, he's awful big. He's a big, big man if that's a dude in this tree line." Said about this time, now mind you, it's getting dark, but he's like, the guy crouches down on all fours and kind of sneaks out, bear crawls, if you will, on all fours out to this pig. And he said the first pig that's down, he said he does it quickly. It's like, it's not real slow, like it's fast. Like he moves real quick across the ground, grabs this hog with one hand and throws it back towards the tree line he came out of. Now, there's not given distance that it is, but either way, how far do you think you could throw a 70 to 100-pound pig? I'm betting not very far.
5 feet?
Yeah. So he throws this hog, this big man that come out of the tree line, over his shoulder, not to carry, but like back into the trees. And the father says that as this big man throws this pig, you can see others in the trees moving, running towards where the hog hit the ground. The creature then proceeds to move fast in the bear crawling fashion out to the other hog, grabs it, picks it up, then stands up on both legs, turns and runs into the trees where he threw the other pig, where these other upright creatures were running back and forth, grabbing the pig he had thrown. So I take that story. I'm like, well, first of all, what was that? You know, nobody's on somebody else's land stealing shot hogs. You just, this isn't something that takes place, not just in Texas, but takes place anywhere. So then the fellow proceeds to say that the land, there was about 20-acre plot next to him that a couple out of Dallas and their kids purchased and moved in about a year or so after he had the sighting in the wheat field. He said he'd never had anything happen before. He'd never had anything happen since. That was his only experience with something strange on that wheat field. So the people bought the land right next door to his land and had a nice house out there. And he said he likes to call them homesteaders. He's like, these are the people that come from the city and they buy them some land and they have them a house and a little barn. And next thing you know, they buy goats and chickens and all this. Like they're, you know, green acreing it up down here on this place.
Right. Yeah.
He said they only lived there for like 4 or 5 months. And then he noticed a for sale sign gone. I mean, it's boom and they nothing. So he said he's driving by one day, him and his son are driving by one day, and the dad's outside at the house for sale, the neighbor dad's outside packing some stuff up. So he pulls in the driveway and jumps out and starts asking. He's like, hey, man, everything going all right? He's like, yeah, everything's going good. He's like, you got it for sale already? He's like, yeah, this ain't for us. He's like, it's not for you. He goes, I thought this was y'all's dream. And he's like, yeah, yeah, well, it's not what we expected. And he's like, well, y'all got her up for sale. He's like, I hope it sells and all this stuff. He's like, where's the fam, you know, and all that stuff. He's like, well, they're already living back in Dallas. He's like, really? So he kind of pressed him a little bit and said the father wouldn't say anything. He's like, I'm just here to gather up a few things, and I'm leaving too. He's like, yeah, we haven't stayed the night here in a long time. And that was all he would lead on to say, and then he left. And as far as I know, there was no more follow-up, no more anything. And he was like, you know, the fella's like, I wonder if it was something from whatever they saw. Maybe they saw something or had a dealings with something that they didn't like.
Right,
I don't know. Now, the other story I was told.
You got another one.
Another one that took place in East Texas. And I'm not, you know, sure about the time. And I'm hoping to get the link. So if I'm wrong, maybe somebody else knows these stories and will send me the links. I'd like to know. But allegedly something happened where there was a road cut into the woods. And they were going to have like some houses. And from what it sounds like, it was going to be like a trailer house area. They were going to go in there and put a trailer park in. So they were cutting some roads through the woods. And one was a pretty good length, one single road way back in there. And one house at the dead end of it was a trailer house back there. And from what the story sounds like is that the sheriff's department in that area already had that trailer under surveillance because they believed that there was a manufacture of methamphetamine going on in this house. So the story goes as they received a phone call from a frantic Hispanic male inside the house that was yelling something about bring the police, that they were under attack, and that they were monsters outside. And that's all that they could kill. That's all that they could get clearly from it is it was broken English. So we're not sure if maybe the person on the phone didn't speak English, like English wasn't their first language, or it was, you know, they could easily speak English, but under such stressful situations, they couldn't hold it together. It was back and forth with broken English and Spanish. So the story goes as that they were could hear gunfire on the end of the police department, could hear gunfire of coming from the phone call.
Really?
That this Hispanic male was extremely frantic, saying and screaming something about monsters and to send help. And then that was it. And so the police show up. But, of course, they don't go charging right in because they're under the assumption, too, well, this easily could have been a drug deal gone bad, rival drug, you know,
right,
traffickers, yeah, something. You don't want to get in the middle. You know, you got to ease into it. You don't just walk up in there like you're going to rescue somebody, get shot.
Yeah, exactly.
So they made their way to it. Story goes that they had found a few dead individuals outside the trailer and that they had handguns and empty shell casings around their bodies, but that there were no gunshot wounds that caused their death. It looked like they had been accosted, that they had been bludgeoned or beaten to death.
The predator showed up.
Exactly. They found a few more and that the only people that they had found surviving this whole attack was a young boy and his little sister. And that they didn't speak any English. And the only thing that they could get coming out of them was they just said the monsters came. The monsters came. And that's all that it was. And that the sheriff's department, of course, you know, took custody of them and locked the area down and went through it. And that was really the only thing left that they could find about the story. So both of these stories may be complete and total horse crap. I don't know. Or There may be some more to it. So I'll hopefully get some links and some get some more information on those stories. But either way, neither one of them were from long ago. They were all within the last 5 years. So yet again.
Oh, my God. Last 5 years.
Yeah, I believe the last 5 years is when
in Texas.
In Texas, in East Texas, that this went down. So, again, it's back over in East Texas, back over in the Piney Woods, you know, stuff like that. So
I don't think. I know we've said it 100 times on here, but people don't realize how thick and dense the woods are out there.
It's wild. I mean, any good patch of woods in any state you're in, when you look at it, imagine if that was just a massive amount of wood.
You know, back to your story, if it was a rival gang that had, say, they were dressed up wearing monster masks and came in there and killed everybody, there would be bullet holes. But these people were crushed to death.
Looked like they were beaten to death. Yeah.
Or beaten to death. Man, that.
My thing is this, is like if it was the young boy that called, he would be the reason that they were monsters, right? And maybe that's what he believed, is they're out there killing and being monsters, like you said. Whether they were wearing masks or whether they were the other people in his family that was killed said they were monsters. But you would find the extra, you know, and they don't ever go into boot prints or footprints, but you would find the remains of a gun battle where not only did you send rounds, you received rounds.
Well, and mind you, lots of these guys, if it was like a rival gang or something, they've been getting into altercations like this their entire life. If you have a secretive, secluded meth lab in the middle of the woods, you're not going to call the police to come help you if you have a problem.
By the time you've gone this far down the rabbit hole, you're not worried of a little gunplay.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you're kind of seasoned to this whole idea. So, yeah, it does make you wonder exactly. I have so many questions for both those stories, you know, like we discussed, is what could possibly throw a pig that far?
You know, I don't know.
That's me. There's a lot of these things. So I have no idea, but it's both of those stories were extremely, extremely interesting. I've got two shows going to be coming up that I'm going to do for the Elite shows. And I've got some more on a hermit that I really want to discuss. And then I've got something that took place here in Texas that's rather funny that I actually got to see. So I'm going to cover both on those, the Elite shows, of a crazy camel cavalry that I'm going to talk about, and then some more that has to do with some more like Native American hermits.
That sounds awesome. If you want access to those, you got to sign up by going to the website, expandedperspectives.com, and click on the Elite tab. It's only $5 a month. You get access to additional shows every month, including the entire back catalog. If you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, don't hesitate. Email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call us 817-945-3828. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
I have got samples to pull. They're remodeling my office, so my office looks like a bomb zone. They've thrown me out of it. I don't know how long it's going to take to fix it. So I'm kind of in limbo. You know, we're moving to another room and all this, and then when they get it rebuilt, we'll get to move back in. So this week, I don't know, but I am going to get after that pig some more this week. I am going to seal the deal on that big old swine.
I can't wait for those ribs. I'm going to be installing a new swimming pool. I know everybody know that last summer I complained and moaned about having to move all the sand by hand with the wheelbarrow. And
tell them what happened.
We had some bad storms about 2 weeks ago, and it was really windy, and it pretty much caved in the side of the pool and bent all the things holding it up so
destroyed
bad
it.
That it's probably going to cost me almost as much as buying the brand new one. So I just cut it up into pieces and put it out for the garbage, and I just bought a new one. So I'm setting that up.
The boys will be happy.
Yeah, they're excited because they were really sad when they were like, oh, man. They love the pool. And it keeps them out of my hair. So it's money well spent.
It's cheap entertainment.
$500 is money well spent.
If it wasn't for the wind, you'd still have it.
I can't believe we've been through several storms.
Yeah.
It never did. Now, okay, I drained most of the pool. I left about a foot of water in it. I thought that foot of water
will hold it down. Never drain it.
I'm not going to now. Now I'm just going to keep it going all year round. That's the moral of the story. That's what I'm going to be doing. So,
yay.
I hope everybody out there has a good one. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson, and he's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.